Good afternoon, and welcome. Welcome those of you here with us in the dining room. Welcome to our C-SPAN audience. I'm Tim O'Brien, and I am not now, nor have I ever been, a member of the Federalist Society. You, of course, do not have to be a member of the Society to recognize the contributions that it's made to promoting discussion, debate, and a full understanding of issues, often controversial issues, that divide us all. Divide us along party lines, but divide brother and sister around the breakfast table. With the guests that we have today, the program should fall well into that category. As we all know, our judges have great power, and they have exceptional independence, especially our federal judges who serve for life. Many state judges, on the other hand, have less independence, but much greater accountability to the public. What role, if any, does accountability play in the judicial process? Our guests today are Randall Shepard, Chief Justice of the Indiana Supreme Court, and Harold C., an Associate Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court. And their accomplishments are numerous, broad, great, too many to list here. But briefly, Chief Justice Shepard is a graduate of Princeton University, Yale Law School, and he holds a Master of Laws from the University of Virginia. Justice C. holds a bachelor's from Emporia State in Kansas, a master's in economics from Iowa State, and a J.D. from the University of Iowa College of Law, where he graduated with honors and was awarded the Order of the Court. He practiced with Sidley & Austin, a well-known firm here in Washington. For more than 20 years, he taught at the University of Alabama Law School. 10 years ago, in 1996, he was elected an Associate Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court. Here's the format that we're going to have. Each justice will have about 8 minutes for opening remarks. Then we'll have an opportunity to address one another's remarks. And then we're going to open it up to discussion, not only among ourselves, but also with you. And please, if you do have a question or a comment you'd like to address to anybody on the panel, wait for a microphone to come to you. They will be circulating around the room. This is being broadcast on C-SPAN. We do want to record your audio. We're going to begin with Chief Justice Shepard.
Thank you. Good afternoon to everybody. You know, you've all been brought here under the pretense of hearing people talk about whether judicial elections are a threat to judicial independence. Many of you being lawyers will know that appellate judges are fond of recasting the question. And I'm going to recast it just slightly. For the reason that I'm going to suggest that independence is not an end of its very own. You know, long before the phrase or the term telephone justice was invented to describe what happened in the Soviet Union, our American revolutionaries understood the notion that a separate and independent judiciary had value. Thomas Jefferson said in the Declaration of Independence, most famously, he, meaning the king, has made judges dependent on his will alone. And so from the very beginning of the country, with respect to the judiciary, there are two very different forms of independence put into the Constitution of the United States and, by and large, into state constitutions. One is an administrative independence. That is, the judiciary would not be a part, as it was in England, a part of the executive branch, but its own separate operation. And secondly, a kind of decisional independence, that is to say, the freedom to decide cases without concern about retribution in the ordinary course of business. This shows up in the federal system by the creation of life tenure, by making it very difficult to remove any judges about whom one is unhappy, and what is the no diminution clause. Judges' salaries should not be diminished during the judge's term of office, and these three principles, in one way or another, are embedded in most state judicial systems. When they put the Constitution of the United States to ratification, its proponents were quite clear about why these were important. And in Federalist 78, perhaps the best known of the Federalist papers on this topic, the proponents declare that the purpose of this separation is to secure the steady, upright, and impartial administration of the laws. Now, Justice Thomas has recently reminded us why that impartiality matters, why that independence matters. at a dinner of the Federalist Society during the annual convention one year, he said, judges must be independent so that they can be impartial. And if they are not impartial, they're no longer judges. Now, with respect to elections, and with respect to appointments, and with respect to Missouri plan systems, and pretty much up and down the line, it seems to me that the rules of the selection system play as much a role in affecting partiality and impartiality as the method of selection itself. I want to explain that. For at least the last four generations, since President Taft laid down on the table on behalf of the American Bar Association the basic rules of judicial behavior, earlier called canons, now called the Code of Judicial Conduct, two principles with respect to impartiality, among others, have been embedded in the American judicial mind. One of those is what's now called, in the modern world, the commit clause. And in its modern version, what it says is that a judge or a candidate for judge shall not commit to parties or classes of parties or to issues or to controversies that might become before the judge. What is called the disqualification clause says that, in effect, any judge who does that ought not sit on the case which puts those parties, class of parties, or controversies before the judge. Now, there is in the country at the moment a great tug of war over whether those two rules ought to be abolished. A series of lawsuits in places like Kentucky, North Carolina, Florida, Indiana, Kansas, Arizona, attacking, among others, those two ideas. And most of the rulings so far have a pattern. The pattern is that it's unconstitutional to prevent a judge or a candidate from judge with making a commitment about the outcome of controversies, violation of the First Amendment. But it's not unconstitutional for a judge who does that to be obliged to disqualify. And where that has led us is easiest to see, actually, in judicial elections, though, as I said earlier, I think it isn't in any way confined to judicial elections. In Alabama, for example, where there are hard-fought races going on this year, in the primary, the sitting Chief Justice had an opponent who ran a commercial that said, Chief Justice neighbors set aside the death penalty for a vicious thug who raped and killed a pregnant woman. Don't vote for him, vote for me. Now, the commercial did not reflect the fact that neighbors' vote was compelled by prevailing authority of the U.S. Supreme Court. But the commercial said, vote for me, don't vote for him, he's the kind of guy who does that sort of thing, grants new trials on penalty to vicious thugs. There's another famous battleground in the country at the moment is Southern Illinois. A judge running in Southern Illinois says, vote for me, and I'll take care of those plaintiffs' lawyers and their frivolous lawsuits. Which, if you're a defendant, is a pretty good thing, right? But not if you're an injured claimant. And finally, the most remarkable statement of all for this year, as far as I'm concerned, is a member of a state Supreme Court who said, when the U.S. Supreme Court has made a ruling that we think governs the case in front of us, but we think the ruling is wrong, we shouldn't follow it. We should make them order us to follow it. Now, I say that's not law and order. That's lawlessness. That's the Ninth Circuit. Okay? Right. That's the Ninth Circuit. But, and on this point, federal judges and state judges are in exactly the same boat. Recall that the White House said, when Justice Roberts was nominated, Justice Roberts should not be obliged to answer questions on controversies and classes of cases that will come before us. And the question is, why not? If the purpose of the selection system is to identify the outcome before the evidence is heard, then you ought to know what that judge is going to do and whether the evidence is one way or another, or the prevailing case law is one way or another, is a matter of no moment. And that takes me to the question of money. It makes a lot of difference in elections how big the jurisdiction is. In my state, there are places, even some pretty big places, where people run for judge by putting up yard signs. They say, vote for Jones. But you can't do that if you're running for the Supreme Court of Ohio or the Supreme Court of Texas. The only way to do that is to run commercials. And most of those commercials have nothing to do with the things we customarily associate with the qualifications of judges, like experience and education and integrity. They have to do with the hot-button issues. I'm a pro-choice judge. Elect me and I'll tackle the Med-Mal crisis. Elect me, I believe that the rights of victims are as important as the rights of defendants. Elect me and I'll defend traditional marriage. That's what those commercials are about, and they're very expensive. Texas used to hold the record in this. Still number two. Since 1993, judges in Texas have reported spending $28 million on races for the Texas Supreme Court. They have been eclipsed by Alabama, which in that same period has spent $48 million, $7.3 million this year alone. Two of the candidates in those races have received a majority of their money from PACs dependent on a single lobbyist. Two different lobbyists, not the same guy. Neither one's named Abramoff. Okay? But money funneled by individuals into those campaigns. Now, interest groups play an important role in our society. They're terrific mediators of disputes. They are mediators of legislation. Put that clause in or take it out, and we will assent or we will lay off to the passage of this bill or that bill. But Justice Thomas has pointed out that interest groups are not appropriate actors in the judicial arena. By their very nature, he said, interest groups are biased, and a judge should not be. What the rules of engagement are, whether they're in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee or in a retention election in Tennessee or a partisan election in some other state, make a difference in who comes to the game. And the more exuberant and blatant the rules of engagement are, the more likely it is that the game will attract exuberant, muscular, and blatant players who are more likely to think of the judiciary as a place where policymaking is a lot of fun. And to expand the relative role of judges at the expense of elected officials in the other branches. And as Justice Scalia said to Nadine Strossen recently in their soiree in front of the American Civil Liberties Union, you may be able to make this happen, Nadine, but in the end, I don't think you will like the outcome. And I don't think we should either.
Thank you, Chief Justice Shepherd. We're going to hear now from Justice C, who doesn't have to worry about an election until 2008.
or a few days before that. I think the question is independent of what? If we want an independent judiciary, we want them independent of what? It seems to me there's one thing we don't want judges independent of, and that's the law. I think we believe judges should be dependent upon the law, that they should be accountable to the law, that it's the law that they owe their duty to. In the drafting of the Constitution, the independence that was that was of concern was independence from the other branches of government. In fact, if we look at the move from state judiciary into election rather than appointment, it was precisely in order to increase the independence of the judiciary that was done. By removing them from the backroom political deals, it was viewed that the judiciary would be a stronger element and better able to stand up for itself against those other branches. The discussion that we typically hear today, though, is independence from the public. We want judges to be independent from the public, from voters. If we are concerned about judges being accountable to the law, seems to me the question is, well, who's going to hold them accountable? Are we going to have no one hold them accountable? If no one holds them accountable, we don't have a judicial commission. We don't have impeachment. We don't have any of those things. We just let them do whatever they want to do. But if someone's going to hold them accountable, the question is, well, who ought to hold them accountable? Who's in the best position to hold them accountable? As we hear this debate about judicial selection that's going on across the country, There are three things that we normally hear, and I at least heard two of those from Justice Shepard, certainly one, the first one, and that is we've got this problem with money. There's money that flows into judicial elections. The second one is tone. Well, these ugly things are being said. And the third one that generally comes up a little later in the discussion is, well, the public just doesn't know how to choose judges in, for one reason or another. And so these are the three things that I normally hear brought up. The conclusion from that, though, we jump from there's this problem with money, there's this problem with tone, there's this problem with the ability of voters to choose wisely when they're choosing judges. Therefore, we should have, usually the argument is merit selection. That's the term that's used for an initial appointment with a subsequent retention election. Or we should restrict judicial campaigning. And I'd submit that that's an enormous jump. First, these problems of money, tone, and inability are not limited to elections. With respect to money, the question is, who's the audience? Who is it that's making the selection? Yeah, money goes into elections if voters are choosing judges, but there's a battle going on, right? I mean, we're aware that there are powerful interests. Alexis de Tocqueville told us 150 years ago, 180 years ago, whatever it was, that every dispute, every important dispute in the United States ends up in the courts. You know, courts get involved in these things. So so interest groups are very interested in the judiciary and what the judiciary does. There's a lot of money at stake. We just heard the allusion to, you know, the plaintiff's trial bar and corporate defendants. And, you know, there's enormous sums, millions, hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of dollars at stake. It is not a surprise that people with a lot of money or strong interest in the outcome of cases is going to get involved in one way or another. But they're going to get involved with respect to who the decision maker is. And so if there are elections, that money will be spent on television ads. If it's appointment, you'd expect it to be spent elsewhere. But even where the appointment was by the president with confirmation by the Senate, the Brennan Center reports that $1.3 million was spent on television advertising in the, you know, easy confirmation of Chief Justice Roberts. $2.4 million was spent on television in the confirmation of Samuel Alito. So enormous sums of money are being spent in an appointive process. I would submit to you it's probably the same amount of money because the same interest is at stake. It's just in elections you see the money, and where it's appointment, that money, I don't know, goes through some of those lobbyists he was referring to and finds its way into the critical decision maker in other ways, or to influencing the decision maker in other ways. The tone of elections. Isn't it awful, the things that get said? Well, yeah, I wasn't too keen about some of the things that got said during the Clarence Thomas confirmation or during the Harriet Myers nomination. The examples we typically hear in state elections are, wasn't it awful the way they attacked Rose Byrd in California, Penny White in Tennessee? They're both in initial appointment followed by retention election states, the system that people go to when they say, oh, isn't it awful what happens in elections? How about inability to select? Well, as I mentioned, we have a problem with appointments, too. Does the governor or does the Bar Association always choose the people who are the very best judges for the public, or do they, you know, favor the people that they went to college with or the people that that they belong to the same club with and share the views that they hold? I would submit to you that these problems are problems with judicial selection regardless of the system. There are loads of things we can say about that, and I'll rely on your questions for most of it, but I do want to make two points. First, as I mentioned, judges have a profound impact on our society, and so we ought to expect this problem of tone, which may not be public. If you just have to condemn the person before a decision maker, then you can spread the rumors there, and you don't have to spread them to everybody. But we should expect that. We should expect the money. to flow. It just may not see it in some places rather than others. Well, the argument then is made, well, we need to have our judiciary, they need to have public confidence in our judiciary, and if the public sees the money, if they hear the comments, that detracts from public confidence. I refer to this as the whited sepulcher theory. That is, it's okay that there are rotting bones here as long as the public doesn't know. If you slap another coat of whitewash on the sepulcher so that it looks good, then we can have public confidence in our judiciary, even though all this stuff is going on beneath the surface. I have a problem with the strength of our judicial system depending on public ignorance and public deception. I think we're far better off to know what's going on and deal with those problems. The second point that I'd like to make in opening is that we're dealing here with a fundamental question as to whether we trust voters generally to make wise decisions. We understand they're going to make mistakes. Governors are going to make mistakes. Everybody's going to make mistakes. But do we trust voters generally to make wise decisions in the selection of judges? Right, first argument, as I mentioned, the judiciary depends on public confidence in order for it to work. So do the other two branches, right? If the public lose confidence in its legislature, the legislature isn't going to be effective. If they lose confidence in the executive branch isn't going to be effective. We're dealing with representative government here. All three branches depend upon public confidence. Well, the argument is the judiciary is different. Yeah, every office is different. You don't use the same standards to pick a legislature that you do a school superintendent or an attorney general. And you don't use the same standards to select a judge. So the fundamental question is, can voters choose the best person for the particular office? Are they wise enough to pick a different person for legislator than they do for school superintendent? I submit to you that they are, and I submit to you if they aren't, we have a much more fundamental problem here. And that is the entire system, apparently, is incapable of functioning. There's a fundamental constitutional question that it seems to me we're here to address. In the last century, we've developed an alternative theory of how judges ought to behave, the activist theory, whether it's conservative or liberal. The judges ought to be activists. The judges ought to be involved intimately in the making of policy, as opposed to what I would call a declarative system, a system where judges are supposed to declare what the law is. You look about, and I noticed on the news last night something about a proposition in Oregon. Oregon has a constitutional provision that says no law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of this right. Well, it turns out in the case State versus Cianelli or Cianelli, some pronunciation such as that, I'm not out in Oregon, that the Oregon Supreme Court decided that free expression of opinion includes live sex performances. They dropped the opinion when they talked about it. They didn't say free expression of opinion. They said this is free expression. But the constitutional provision says free expression of opinion. You know, when we have judges running schools, running prisons, questions of gay marriage, questions of right to life or right to choice, you know, these are fundamental policy questions. Now, if it's appropriate for courts to do these things, then it seems to me you can't argue it's not appropriate for voters to vote on the same way they do other legislators in the legislative branch. If, on the other hand, it's inappropriate for courts to do this, or if it's even open to question as to whether it's appropriate or inappropriate, then it seems to me voters ought to be allowed to choose what their interpretation of the Constitution is. The Constitution is not written for judges. It is written for the average citizen. Remember, Santa Anna complained about those Americans coming into Texas with their Constitution, copies of the Constitution in their pockets, talking about their rights. Those folks came out of the hills of Tennessee with a copy of the Constitution in their pocket and felt they ought to hold the Mexican government to abide by the United States Constitution. Well, it seems to me, fundamentally, constitutional questions are questions for the electorate. And if judges are going to be involved in making policy, then it seems to me the voters have the right to decide whether those are the judges they want or whether they want judges who will be declarative judges.
Thank you. Thank you, Justice Chief. Brief rebuttal.
Mention a few words about federal confirmations. You know, one of the great events that occurred last year was a poll of California judges asked, would you like to switch over to an appointment and confirmation system like they have in Washington? said, no, thank you. I'll take my chances with the voters of California. But ponder for a moment what confirmation would be like and what the country would be like if you could only get confirmed by the Senate, passed out by the Judiciary Committee, if your views about the Constitution were congenial to 60% of the Senate, what kind of legal regime would that be? The Bill of Rights and the Constitution are designed to save the public from those bodies. That's part of why the Bill of Rights is there. And if the notion becomes embedded that it's legitimate to probe an Alito or a Scalia or a Ginsburg point by point on what she will do with respect to individual controversies that might arise, and she can only get confirmed if 60% of the Senate thinks that's suitable, she is unlikely to be someone capable of protecting the rights of individual citizens from overreaching by the branches of government. I once asked Bob Bork, this is right after his unpleasant experience, whether he thought that an elected judge was entitled to take a more muscular stance vis-a-vis the other branches of government. This would be in a state system, not an elected system. Was an elected judge entitled to have a broader writ against, say, the legislature or the governor because of being elected? They're elected. I'm elected. I'm entitled to do more because I'm not an unelected judge. I'm an elected judge. And the answer he gave me, which I must say I thought flip at the time, and I've changed my mind, as is often the case, Bob Bork managed to take an idea and confine it or get it into about 8 words. He said, I don't understand why the voters would hire 2 people to do the same job. Well, that's right. Why would you have why would you have 3 people doing the same job? Take workers' comp. This is a place where state judicial elections in certain states, the high court of the state is sort of the big workers' comp board in the sky, right? Why would you have a legislature writing up workers' comp statutes and a executive branch commission deciding who ought to get paid and who shouldn't get paid, and then a set of judges who say, well, I read what the statute says and I've read what the board says, but it doesn't seem like good policy to me. I think I'll do otherwise. Why would you do that? And it's not the way Americans think their government is. So the sense in which judges are emboldened to be overreaching has to do with what we extract out of them and what kind of people we attract when we say it's legitimate to stand up, as a judge said in Arkansas, and say, elect me and no one who is ever found guilty of drunk driving will ever escape jail. Period. Now, in my state, the law says I'm supposed to consider the individual offense and the individual offender. Is this 0.08 or 0.21? Is it a first offense or a fourth offense? Does this person have a job or not? Do they admit their guilt or not? I'm supposed to take those things into account in deciding whether you get intensive supervision or probation or work release or prison. The judge in Arkansas said, I don't need to know that. Don't need to know any of it. I promise you that regardless of facts or law, here's how that case will come out. It's not a happy place to have your things that are of importance to you adjudicated.
Well, I share Chief Justice Shepard's concern about the appointive system. I'm real worried about the Senate asking those questions, pushing nominees to say more about what their positions are. I think we also read about the Virginia legislature perhaps doing some of the same thing. That's deeply troubling. That's a deeply troubling problem with an appointive system. Now, it's certainly true that candidates can say all sorts of things when they're running in an election. I do know, you know, two of the examples he gave, I think at least one of them he said came from Alabama. The other one I recognize as coming from Alabama. It was the same person, the same candidate, who said that Chief Justice Neighbors had set aside the death penalty, and who also said, you should not, he wrote an op-ed piece saying that that we were wrong for following what the Supreme Court said. We should have forced them to make us do it. Also made a statement that, they're busy. Maybe they wouldn't get around to it. That was deeply troubling. I might also point out that candidate lost overwhelmingly before the electorate. The question is not what might someone say. The question is what standard will voters hold them to? Now, frankly, and this is anecdotal. I haven't done a thorough survey, but certainly from the cases I've seen, the folks who run those sorts of campaigns lose. I can't say they lose 100% of the time, but I also know that the governor's old roommate doesn't 100% of the time avoid being on the court either. Overwhelmingly, though, from what I've seen, those candidates lose. I think the public wants judges to be judges. It wants to select people for the judiciary who are going to do the judicial job. I think they are selecting two people to do different jobs, and in doing so, they're applying different standards.
Justice Scalia one time said judges ought never respond to criticism referring to federal judges because the public doesn't really understand what a federal judge's job is, an appeals court judge's job. If they don't like the result, they don't like the judge. Strict allegiance to the Constitution sometimes might mean that somebody who is quite clearly guilty of a heinous offense may get a new trial, may even go free. That's very tough for an elected judge to do.
Well, I think it's tough for any judge to do because
an elected judge has his job on the line.
Yeah, and an appointed judge has his friends who may think less of him, or his relatives who are going to complain about him, I think it's tough for every judge. But the question is, are you going to do that? Are you going to do your job or not? I mean, ultimately, I know someone gave an example. I won't say who it was. Gave an example of a trial court judge. Who had said to this appellate court judge, look, I decided that way even though I knew it was wrong, and I figured I'd let you correct it, so that I wouldn't have to deal with the voters on that. Well, there's a problem with that judge. But the problem isn't the elective system. The problem is that judge's integrity. A judge who is willing to do that when he's elected is going to be willing to do something just like it if he's appointed. It's just if he's elected, there's a chance to get him for it. And if he's appointed,
but if he's elected, there's a greater incentive. The job is on the line.
Well, I'm not convinced. But it may well be. I'll concede that for the sake of argument. Let's suppose there is a greater incentive. So what you're saying is we want to protect judges who are weak on integrity.
I'm not saying that.
Oh, right.
We'll take questions from the audience. If there's a microphone over here. Mm-hmm. You did say, before the microphone gets there, you did say that if judges are involved in policy, they should be held accountable. No one can really quarrel with that, accountable to somebody. But judges ought not be the policymakers,
they ought
legislators.
Not. Well, my position is they ought not. That's a job for the legislature. I think that is constitutional doctrine. I think the Constitution says the legislature does the lawmaking, and it says that our job is to declare that law. So I believe that we have no business being in policymaking. Because of that, I would take the view that voters ought to have the right to throw out those judges who do get involved in policymaking. But if you disagree with me and you think judges ought to be making policy, then it seems to me you're hard-pressed to say, and they shouldn't be accountable for it.
Okay. Where is that question? Yeah. Yes.
You here?
Yeah.
Yes, we hear you.
John Vail from the Center for Constitutional Litigation. One, both of you, I mean, there's obviously a tension about to what extent judges should be making counter-majoritarian decisions on constitutional issues. But I think both of you are agreeing that clearly in some circumstances, judges should make those kinds of decisions.
Sure.
The death penalty
example
mm-hmm. you used. And that presents some danger to an elective judge, particularly if a high-profile case occurs in an election, close to an election cycle. Let me posit a hypothetical and just ask both of you to hash it around. If you had a system of elected judges with retention elections, would it make sense to have the retention election be governed by a supermajoritarian number? You would only get off the bench if enough people voted no that somewhere aligned to the same standard your state employed for amending the Constitution.
Chief.
My heart is with you, but I don't think I'm for it. I think once you've made the decision to put the matter to a vote, you're hard-pressed to say the public can vote no and it doesn't matter. Now, there are states where it works the opposite. That is to say that in order to get retained, you have to have more than half. And I guess the premise of that is that if having had a good look at you for a period of time, 50.1% say yes, maybe you're not the best apple in the barrel, right? And we ought to get somebody else. But I think that once you make the decision to apply the democratic principle somewhere, I'd have a hard time. I understand the practical argument, but as a matter of democratic theory, I suppose I have a hard time seeing how one justifies saying any affirmative no vote of the population is not good enough. In our state, it's one more than half. It doesn't bother me to put my name on the ballot every so often, and so far they've been good to me.
Well, my heart's not even with you. I have a problem with retention election, and the problem is that I don't think it generates the information that elections are supposed to generate. I agree with the principle. I think, in fact, contested elections are essentially a referendum on a sitting judge. As long as there's no problem, odds are that person's going to be reelected, just the same as with your legislator or with, you know, whatever, your school superintendent, whoever it is. What the public wants is a chance to throw out the people who aren't behaving right. And so the question is, how do you get that information to the public? Well, I run in a contested election. If somebody is upset with me, they can go to the other party and find out where they need to go to line up supporters and who funds judicial elections and so on. And they can run an effective campaign against me. In a retention election state, there's no opponent, and so there's generally relatively little incentive to generate information about what the judge is doing. But if someone is concerned, then they can wait until 10 days before the election or 5 days before the election, pour a lot of money in. The sitting judge or justice has virtually no opportunity to respond, to give the other side of the story. So I find retention elections not a very effective way to get information to voters. So I have that fundamental problem with it. But, you know, certainly I see no reason to make it supermajoritarian. We already have little enough information flowing.
We usually couch this in terms of either or, appointed or elected. But the debate is actually much broader than that. If you do have an elected system, what is the best way to do that? And should there be limits imposed on candidates? For example, in Alabama, can a nominee accuse a justice of being soft on crime, citing these cases? And if that were to become part of the debate, should a justice go before the public and defend his written decisions and explain why he decided the case as he did? Does that happen in Alabama? And also, what about the restrictions on campaign contributions? May justices in Alabama solicit money from lawyers? May they do it from lawyers who have cases before them?
The answer, yes, they may solicit money, but they're discouraged from doing so, and generally it's done by campaign committees. I'm trying to answer this question a little more broadly. Remember the question that we're asking here. See, the question we're asking is, who ought to be making these decisions? And in couching your question the way you do, the suggestion is there ought to be some entity in government that tells me what I may say and what I may do and what I may not say and what I may not do. I'm kind of from the old school. I'm a little worried about government telling me what I may say and what I may not say or what I may do and what I may not do. I'm much less concerned about the public. And when I start saying things or doing things, if the voter is looking at me and deciding, is this a good judge or not, I ought to be behaving judicially. And if I behave judicially, I found the public I'm one of those folks who voted the same way Chief Justice Neighbors did on this death penalty case. That is to do what the Supreme Court said I had to do on a matter of federal constitutional law. You do that because it's the right thing to do, because it's the judicial thing to do. And then the question is, are voters going to recognize that I'm being judicial? And I find overwhelmingly that they do. That they want someone who's a judge, and they're willing to forgive a decision they disagree with because they understand sometimes judges just have to follow the law.
Length of terms is one of the ways that this that matters on this point. That is to say, the length of term occasionally will allow popular passion to subside till the moment when they have to make another employment decision, if you will. But you're quite right to ask about contributions. Part of the litigation that's now going on through the country has led a couple of U.S. district judges to say that the First Amendment compels a state to permit a sitting judge to ask a litigant face-to-face for money for re-election. And I don't understand why that's so good for our country. You know, what's the argument that that's a great thing, right? There's an old Texas joke, by the way. Lawyer comes in who's got a case pending and says, Judge, I see you've got a re-election coming up, and my client thinks you're doing a whale of a job presiding over this lawsuit and would hate to lose you and is prepared to give $10,000 to your campaign. Judge says, well, thank you. I'm going to have to think about this. Decides he better call the other side. Calls the other side and says, here's what happened. And the lawyer for the other side says, Judge, my client's pretty happy the way things are going, too, and I just feel sure he'd be willing to make an equivalent contribution to your campaign. So the judge decided to take both contributions and decide the case on the merits. Now,
it works,
right. It used to be, there was a time in this country when we had a lot of judges chosen by party bosses for down-ballot offices that nobody paid any attention to, in which a lot of money changed hands. And I think most Americans didn't think that was a very good way to run a court system. And they were right, and they're still right today.
Well, I certainly think contributions ought to be transparent. There ought to be immediate reporting. The public ought to be aware of what money is going to judges and how it's getting there. We ought not be capable of hiding it in pack-to-pack transfers and that sort of thing. It ought to be transparent. But let me give you, rather than a story, let me give you a real situation in Alabama. We had a sitting chief justice at one time who called lawyers, perfectly legal and within the canons, called lawyers who had cases before the Supreme Court and asked them for contributions. His opponent pointed out he was doing that, and his opponent won. I think voters are capable of making these decisions. I believe in this system we have. I believe ordinary voters, ordinary citizens, are capable of making decisions about who's a good judge and who's not a good judge.
Why, by the way, were you troubled by the questions asked in the Senate Judiciary Committee about opinions on controversies? Why does that trouble you?
It troubles me because I don't think judges should be making promises about how they're going to decide cases.
Well, why do you think it's a good thing in elections?
I don't. I think it's a bad thing. Well, and I think voters ought to vote against people who do it.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I'm Julian Tepper from the Tepper Show, AM 570, and a practicing attorney. Except for a couple of anecdotes, and I realize the issue is framed in terms of process, how should we select judges, it seems to me that one thing that's been left out of the discussion, perhaps because it had to be left out, because maybe there are no data, is the results. In other words, it seems to me the way to measure what's better, if you're just between the two, elections, appointments, is to do a study of the decisions of elected justices, judges, and appointed judges and justices, and to see if there is a discernible difference to a statistically significant degree. If there is, then operate on that basis. If there are no differences of that kind, then it seems to me the answer to the question is it doesn't really matter. But has anybody ever done a study of the decisions? I appreciate the anecdotes.
Yes.
But they are just anecdotes.
Right. And they're not fungible goods, Supreme Court cases.
Mostly here about state judges, and it seems to me that it's easy to chart the decisions on similar issues, use neutral criteria, and come up with a measurement, not in terms of good or bad, but, you know, has the law, the facts, and integrity been the basis for the decision, more in one instance than in the other, or not?
There have been a couple of studies done, and if you get my computer out, I can tell you who the authors are, but I don't remember off the top of my head. But it was a comparison of elected versus Missouri plan, or, you know, initial appointment with retention election, and the results indicate in terms of quality of judges, and you know, all these things are hard to measure, but you know, in terms of quality of judges and outcome, and they found no discernible difference between the two systems. That it seems to be throws us back on other questions, and that is, you know, I guess in particular, do we want voters to be deciding who their judges are, or do we want a system that generally is dominated by the Bar Association choosing who you may choose your judges from?
You know, Dean, I don't know if this is possible, but I believe there has been some research, and if we can get it, post it on the Federalist Society's webpage.
Sure. Yeah.
We will try to. I know the American Judicature Society has been way out front on this. They happen to favor merit selection, but we'll get that on your website.
Yeah, and in fact, it was published. The one I'm talking about was published in the Judicature Society Journal. I have it on my computer. I can pull it up and show you.
Is there a question here? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My question, I don't know if the justices know this or not, but I'm wondering whether or not any other countries elect judges, and if so, what their experience has been with that type of election system.
Are we
unique in the world?
Well, I would say I don't think we're unique, but certainly the European tradition has not been election. It has largely been appointment. It's been appointment by the government on advice of the bar. It's a very, in England, I think, a rather genteel proposition, though a pretty rigorous one. I can't tell you that there are, I think it's not, certainly in the common law world, I think we're probably outnumbered. And even here, of course, we've gone back and forth. This is one of the oldest debates in the history of the nation. At the beginning of the country, it was largely an appointed arrangement. After Andrew Jackson, mostly not. And then in the 20th century, a bit of a swing backwards or away, at least from partisan election, though I think now things have sort of stabilized. Not much has changed anywhere in the last 20 years or so.
I think probably was it 69 or something. Wasn't that the last
Yeah. Judges in Europe, I don't think, are held in as high esteem over there as they are here. Justice Scalia likes to joke about his friends in Europe couldn't understand why anybody with any sense would leave academia to become a judge. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Over here. Again, speak into the microphone. The C-SPAN microphones do want to pick you up.
I'd like to ask about a confusion that I have and see if you can help me out with this. There was a major premise that was given that judges who are policymakers should be held accountable. Then I think there's a minor premise that most of us would agree with, which is that federal judges are policymakers. Why is the conclusion, therefore, not that there should be a way to make federal judges more accountable? And that federal judges should not be treated necessarily the same way they were 200 years ago, just as presidential power is not the same as it was then, judicial power is not the same then.
Well, there is more debate now, I think, about the federal system, and it derives from this notion that the broader writ the judiciary assumes, the more likely it is to encounter people who find its rulings disagreeable, and the heftier those are, the more entitled people are to feel deeply about them. I don't frankly give a lot of thought to changing the federal arrangement because it has 200 years of steam behind it, and it's just inconceivable to me, really, that the nation would decide to make a change. And there certainly are moments when we wouldn't want them to, right? There's a new book about the district judges in the South who carried out Brown versus Board of Education. If you were somebody who drew that short straw, you had to have a real iron bottom, and you had to know that you were going to be shunned at church, the very place where you grew up. You were going to be avoided in the grocery store, and in the absence of Article III protection, query would that story have been written in a different way? So I don't carry a lot of water for that, though I agree with the major premise. That is to say, you got to expect that the broader circle the judiciary creates for itself, the more likely it is that people of goodwill and consequence are going to push back. Now, what's the answer to that? It seems to me that one of the great new words in our lexicon, John Roberts has given us, which is modesty. You know, modesty about your role and your assignment vis-a-vis your fellow citizens and other governmental actors. And that there, at least, there's a chance of causing things to happen. The Republicans in this last, in the Alito confirmations, for example, were able to say, we had no doubt about what nominee Ginsburg might think on various topics, but we voted for her anyway, without trying to extract commitments from her on abortion or the death penalty or other matters, because we believe her to be a very able person, a hardworking person, a conscientious and scholarly individual who will serve the nation well. That was right. And it also gave them a principled place to stand when the tormentors of Roberts and Alito stood up and said, we want to know how they're going to vote. It seems to me that those devices have some chance of some success.
Let me just add one little thing, and that is the debate over selection of federal judges is also made a little more complicated by the fact that that federal judges are to represent the federal interest over state interests. And if they're elected, the query who would elect them. But that just makes the discussion a little more complicated.
But the constituency of elected state judges and federal judges is the same. It's the law. It's the Constitution.
That's right.
Okay. I found it interesting when Supreme Court nominees would say, I'm not going to answer that question because were it to come before me as a judge, I would want to have an open mind and I don't want to have the appearance of bias. I don't understand that answer because certainly we know where judges are on the Supreme Court on large issues. What the answer, it seems to me, really is what we're talking about here. And the independence of the judiciary, if you're going to vote me up or down on the basis of how I'm going to decide a case, well, then maybe you ought to be the judge, not me. Just as we don't want judges legislating from the bench, you don't want senators deciding cases from the committee room. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other questions? Yes, over here.
The Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court has suggested that perhaps part of the solution to this problem is the idea that there's a concern for employment by judges that their employment continue. And he said, well, why is that? We have more than enough good apples in the barrel. Why not simply give you one shot? You get one term and you go, particularly at the appellate level. So you get a he suggested, I believe, for instance, for the Michigan appellate courts that a 12-year term would be sufficient, and there's no chance for reappointment, either by appointment or by election. I'm just wondering what your thoughts might be on that, either at the appellate and or the trial level.
I think that's a pretty good idea, actually. I haven't teased out all of the implications of it, but as long as Chief Justice Taylor could get one more chance, I think I'd be for it.
And I have advocated the same thing, a single 12-year term.
You know, Justice Souter said that his advice when he joined the court was that you don't really get to know your way around here for the first 3 years. And then he said that advice was bad. It actually took him about 5 years. And the risk you might have with that is your most experienced, your most able judges, judges who are able to develop a comprehensible coalition to make a strong statement coherently, you might lose that.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. So, is there one more question? One more question over here, then we'll call it an afternoon.
Thank you. I'm just wondering what the justices think about the idea that in a world where state records for spending and fundraising are being smashed in state after state, whether it's time to think differently about recusal and whether recusal is a valuable tool if it's reconsidered as to when a judge should recuse if contributors or lawyers appearing before them, which is often most of the contributions, are giving them larger and larger checks. And if not, does that argue for stripping away other recusal rules if the public is allowed to simply decide?
I think we clearly have to think seriously about recusal, because if someone is going to make some sort of a commitment, it seems to me they ought to be required, they ought to be disqualified from deciding that case. With respect to contributions, it becomes very awkward to draft some sort of rule. If you have one side in every case contributing to half the justices and the other side contributing to the other half, you now have no one who's deciding cases. We've indicated that we want to elect judges. If we want to elect judges, I think the Supreme Court was right. We ought to take it seriously. We ought to provide the mechanism for them to do that. Chief Justice Shepard mentioned the amount of money spent in Alabama Supreme Court races. I did the calculations. It's less than on a governor's race. It's less than electing the legislature. To elect all of the justices on the Supreme Court, it's less than we spend to elect the governor, less than we spend to elect the legislature. Information is essential to people making their decision. The newspaper editors love to say, well, you shouldn't be raising and spending all this money. And I say, well, you give us free space in your newspaper, and they all say no. I calculated one time, if every voter in the state of Alabama were kind enough to line up and shake hands with me, and I did that 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, it would take me beyond the next election just to shake hands with them, even if there were no new voters coming of age during that time. If you're going to reach them, it's going to cost money, and so somehow or another in those races the money has to be raised. The money is and so the money comes in, and then the question is, well, now can you not decide any cases? And that can't be the intention. But it does seem to me something we need to look at very seriously, because clearly there would be situations where it seems to me it would be inappropriate to decide those cases.
You're absolutely right to focus on recusal as a valuable point of decision in the process. Here I am, a litigant. On the other side of me is somebody who's the lobbyist for the very interest group that is involved in this litigation. Half of the money went to the presiding official before whom I'm now going to plead this case. The question in a state and federal court is, would a reasonable person expect that the tribunal where I am at the moment is likely to be impartial? And the answer largely will be no. The conundrum is that when you create an arrangement that encourages people to run for judge and say, vote for me, I promise I'll do this,
then disqualify the winner because she said that, you've turned the election into a fraud. The promise is unkeepable. Vote for me, and I'll defend the traditional family. Everybody in the electorate knows what that means. Now comes the case. I'm disqualified because I declared my intention. That makes me a fraud from the voter point of view. The voter isn't entitled to say it seems to me under that arrangement. I thought I decided this. I voted for somebody who told me how she or he was going to decide that case, and you tell me that they can't do it at the end of the day? Well, what that says to me is not that the tribunal should be fixed all the way through to the end, where the outcome is decided not after the evidence is heard, but back on Election Tuesday, but rather that the rules of engagement on Election Day ought to be confined to things that have to do with performance in office. Is this person's caseload backlogged? Is the person unattentive? Is this a person who gets reversed all the time? Those aren't the things the commercials are informing people about. The big money commercials don't focus, except about a third of the time, on those matters. They focus on declarations about outcomes.
Justice C has the last word.
Yeah, well, and I think that's why judicial candidates ought to be cautious about what they say and what they promise during the election. Let me say on this topic, though, when you have elected judges, you at least know where the money came from. You have appointed judges, that money's hidden. That money went to, you know, that money went through lobbyists and, you know, went to you know, the governor, or went to people in the legislature, or went to people who are in a decision making capacity on judges. And you never know. At least in an elective system, you see the information. You can, if the rules are right, so that the information is there. At least you can see what's going on and see what you're dealing with, rather than having it hidden in that sepulcher.
Justice C., Chief Justice Shepherd, thank you so much.